On the show today, the Speaker of the House is out.
The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table. The office of Speaker of the House of the United States House of Representatives is hereby declared vacant.
Plus, Donald Trump's fraud trial continues in New York.
The New York Attorney General is aiming to prove that Trump inflated his wealth by lying about his real estate empire. She has accused Trump, his two adult sons, and others of inflating asset values over a decade.
And later, high hopes for Kenya's security forces in Haiti and the cutest political pawns of all time, pandas. Today is Wednesday, October 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. We get an update from New York and find out what Donald Trump is no longer allowed to talk about in just a few minutes. Now, though, an update from Washington. For the first time in U.S. history, a Speaker of the House of Representatives, who is second in the presidential line of succession, has been removed from office. Facing a challenge from within his own party, Republican Kevin McCarthy was removed from the position by a vote of 216 to 210. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
An extraordinary moment in American politics. For the first time ever, the leader of the U.S. House of Representatives has been removed from power.
Speaker of the House of the United States House of Representatives is hereby declared vacant.
Republican Representative Matt Gaetz forced a vote on removing McCarthy, expressing frustration at McCarthy's leadership after he failed to pass a government funding bill last week with conservative spending priorities. Republican Representative Matt Gaetz.
I think $33 trillion in debt is chaos. I think that facing a $2.2 trillion annual deficit is chaos. I think that not passing single subject spending bills is chaos.
McCarthy told reporters he would not run again for the role of Speaker.
I can continue to fight, maybe in a different manner. I will not run for Speaker again.
But the slim Republican majority in the House meant that Gaetz needed only 8 Republican votes, along with all Democrats, to oust McCarthy, who faced increasing criticism since agreeing to a debt ceiling deal earlier this year with President Joe Biden. Republican Representative Bob Good.
Many of us had begged the Speaker, pleaded with the Speaker repeatedly to utilize the debt ceiling to leverage spending cuts and reforms. But instead, he negotiated an unlimited increase to the debt ceiling.
Although the majority of Republicans voted to keep McCarthy in leadership, Republican Representative Tom Cole.
Think long and hard before you plunge us into chaos, because that's where we're headed if we vacate the speakership.
It was the votes of Democrats uniting to remove McCarthy that made the difference. Democratic Representative Pramila Jayapal.
We're not voting in any way that would help save Speaker McCarthy.
Democratic Representative Annie Custer.
He is not trustworthy, and I think you can see that within his own caucus, but you can certainly see it the way he's treated us and the American people.
The historic upheaval in the U.S. House comes at a key moment. The short-term government funding deal did not include U.S. aid to Ukraine. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby.
All the House leadership is supportive of continuing to help Ukraine. And the vast majority of House members on the Republican side are in support of continuing to help Ukraine. There's a small number of very vocal, a small minority of vocal members who are pushing back on that, but they don't represent their party. They don't represent their leadership.
U.S. lawmakers will hold elections next week for a new Speaker of the House. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
It's worth noting here that Matt Gaetz is under investigation from a congressional ethics committee, and McCarthy did not interfere or help him. McCarthy has said that Gaetz's motion to remove him is personal rather than ideological. At least 21 people were killed and 18 injured on Tuesday after a bus carrying tourists crashed off an overpass and caught fire near Venice in northern Italy. The cause of the accident is still unclear, though Venice City Councilor Renato Barrasso said that one line of inquiry was that the driver, a 40-year-old Italian who was among those killed, had become ill before the crash. So far, we know that five of the victims were Ukrainians and one was German. The bus was also carrying passengers from France and Croatia. The mayor of Venice has called the scene apocalyptic. And here are other stories we're following from around the world. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell said on Monday that the bloc remains steadfast in its support for Ukraine, announcing a proposed spending package of up to $5.25 billion for Kyiv in 2024. The World Bank said in its semi-annual regional forecast that it now expects China's economic output to grow to 4.4% in 2024. That's down from the 4.8% it expected in April. The bank cited the persistent weakness of its property sector for the changed outlook. And India has ordered Canada to remove 41 of its 62 diplomats in the country. Tuesday's action by India, first reported by the Financial Times, follows both countries' ousting of each other's senior diplomats 2 weeks ago. The expulsion follows what Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called credible allegations of Indian involvement in the murder of an Indian expatriate living near the Canadian city of Vancouver. India denies any wrongdoing. The stakes are high for former President Donald Trump. He's in New York, where his civil fraud trial is continuing. The judge has already determined that he did indeed lie and commit fraud on business documents. And on Tuesday, that same judge imposed a gag order after Trump disparaged a court clerk on social media. Reuters' Freddie Joyner has more.
Donald Trump's civil fraud trial entered a second day on Tuesday. A case that could end up dismantling his business empire as the former U.S. president seeks to re-enter the White House in 2024.
This woman is grossly incompetent.
He renewed his attacks on Letitia James before the day's proceedings. The New York Attorney General is aiming to prove that Trump inflated his wealth by lying about his real estate empire. She has accused Trump, his two adult sons, and others of inflating asset values over a decade to ensure favorable bank loans and insurance terms, and exaggerating Trump's own riches by more than $2 billion. Early on, the government's first witness, Donald Bender, Trump's former accountant at Mazars USA, resumed his testimony, revealing that financial statements he prepared for the Trump Organization were largely based on self-reported figures. Meanwhile, the trial judge has already ruled that Trump committed fraud and canceled business certificates for companies that control crown jewels of Trump's portfolio, including Trump Tower and 40 Wall Street in downtown Manhattan. James is seeking at least $250 million in fines, a permanent ban against Trump and his sons Donald Jr. and Eric from running businesses in New York, and a five-year commercial real estate ban against Trump and the Trump Organization. Trump has denied wrongdoing, and his lawyers have said they will appeal. Later in the day, the judge overseeing the case imposed a gag order after Trump used social media to lash out against the judge's top law clerk.
That's Freddie Joyner of Reuters reporting. From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. Coming up, cute, lovable pandas are caught in the middle of a geopolitical firestorm, and we get a look at a new kind of comic book. Now, though, an update to a story we brought you on Tuesday. Kenyan President William Ruto has welcomed a new resolution approved Monday by the UN Security Council authorizing a foreign security mission to intervene in Haiti. Ruto says he hopes that the so-called multinational security support mission his country is leading will be different from other international interventions in Haiti. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Miriama Diallo has the story.
In a taped speech shared with the media on Tuesday, Kenyan President William Ruto said he hopes the so-called multinational security support mission, which his country is leading, will make a difference in the lives of Haitians.
I welcome the resolution as an overdue and critical instrument to define the multinational mission. This mission is a fundamental intervention to provide the necessary conditions for Haiti to consolidate its development and governance.
Ruto said it is essential that resources, as well as the operational scope available to the UN team, be appropriately reinforced. This comes after the UN Security Council voted late Monday to authorize a foreign security mission to intervene in Haiti, a year after the Caribbean nation requested help to quell violent gangs. Kenya offered to lead the operation in Haiti 2 months ago, saying it's willing to deploy 1,000 of its police forces. On a recent visit to Kenya, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin lauded the plan.
And we intend to work with the United States Congress to provide up to $100 million in support. And we urge others in the international community to follow Kenya's great example.
Austin was in Nairobi with his Kenyan counterpart, Aden Duale.
Kenya has a very long history of global peacekeeping. We were in Kosovo, we were in Namibia, we were everywhere. We are now in Somalia, we're in DRC. We have our officers in the Tigray monitoring and evaluation mechanism.
But others like Eugene Wamalwa, a former Kenyan defense secretary and the leader of the Democratic Action Party of Kenya, told VOA he has some concerns.
Would expect the process to be transparent. First of all, starting with our National Assembly, our parliament should approve this. We expected that this matter should also be discussed at the AU before being elevated to the UN. You know, the principle of subsidiarity should apply. But here, we first heard of it during UNGA in New York. Then we had the Americans praising us for offering our troops. We're not even aware we are sending our police officers in harm's way. We have not discussed it. We've not agreed as a country.
UN peacekeepers were deployed to Haiti in 2004 after a rebellion led to the ouster and exile of then-president Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Peacekeeping troops left in 2017 and were replaced by UN police, who left in 2019. Amnesty International Kenya on Tuesday urged the UN member states, other human rights organizations, and citizens to thoroughly examine the mission's human rights and humanitarian implications before the deployment. Meanwhile, Kenyans who spoke to VOA are divided on their police force possibly going to Haiti.
We have a lot of problems, not only in the country, but also in Africa. We have problems in Sudan, we have problems in Somalia, we have security problems in several parts of Africa. If we wanted to solve any problem, security problem, we could have started with home or at least regionally.
It will help to cause them to have peace in that country. Number two, to show that this country is a peaceful country, we can exercise peace in other country. That is a very powerful thing this country have learned. Okay, I support it with 100%.
The mission has been initially approved for 1 year with a review after 9 months. It was not immediately clear when Kenya will deploy its police contingent to Haiti, but senior government officials have suggested it could come as soon as early next year. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Comic books, like all writing, are an artifact of their time. They come with all the cultural baggage of the people who wrote them, and in some cases that might mean demeaning stereotypes or simply excluding people altogether. VOA's Genia Dilut has the story of some Muslim comic creators who are working to change Islamic stereotypes in American pop culture.
For cosplayer Kaval Rahman, recalibrating Muslim narratives in comics starts with dressing as Jasmine from Aladdin in an outfit more culturally appropriate than some of the costumes from the 1992 animated movie.
During that time period of when Aladdin took place, the clothing, for instance, that Jasmine wore was not something that during that time period would have been appropriate for her to wear.
Shamika Mitchell organized Salam Fandom to celebrate comic creators following Islamic values.
You have video game creators who, in their work, as opposed to killing everybody, maybe you're just stopping them, or you're pausing them, or they get to regrow, but they change a little bit. So you don't have to have the same kind of tropes that you see in contemporary gaming or contemporary fandom.
The comic book series Zindan focuses on a mythical prison that holds the world's worst criminals. Psychiatrist and comic creator Omar Mirza says it is part of countering stereotypes of Muslim characters as villains and terrorists.
We have a group of people that we call the Ansars, and we draw from Islamic history, which, you know, the Ansars were sort of the Prophet's helpers at the time. And so in our story, the Ansars are sort of like this noble group of folks that are tasked with the responsibility to guard this prison, and then also now that the prison has fallen, to be the ones to sort of return those people to justice.
Muslim Pakistani-American teenager Kamala Khan is Marvel's Miss Marvel, who fights for good and battles all kinds of supervillains. The character is a powerful force against Islamophobia, says Muslim anti-racism collaborative director Marguerite Hill.
When we're able to see our heroes in other faces and other cultures, it really helps humanize other people. So instead of making the other and dehumanizing them, when we're relating to them in their stories, we're able to treat them like full human beings. So it's really powerful through storytelling where we can make a difference.
Hill says Miss Marvel helped her own daughter connect with Pakistani classmates and is a strong representation for Muslim girls around the world. Miss Marvel is scheduled to make her big screen debut later this year in the superhero movie The Marvels. Jenny Adulo, VOA News, San Diego, California.
At least 37 people, including two pregnant women, were burned to death after a blast at an illegal oil refinery in southern Nigeria. Angela Johnston of Reuters reports.
A blast at an illegal oil refinery in southern Nigeria on Monday has killed dozens of people, including two pregnant women. That's according to a local security official and community leader. The explosion took place in Rivers State. Illegal refining is common in the country's oil-rich Niger Delta region. Impoverished locals tap pipelines to make fuel to sell for a profit. But the practice is often deadly. Nigeria has tried to clamp down on illegal refineries for years, but without much success. Local environmental groups say part of the problem is that powerfully connected politicians and security officials are involved. Oil theft is one of the factors pushing major companies operating in Nigeria to shift their focus to deep water operations.
That's Reuters' Angela Johnston. For 31 years, Macedonian-born soccer coach Sasho Kurovski has instilled passion for excellence into the University of Maryland's soccer program. The result is success both on and off the field. VOA's Jane Bojewski reports.
Since his arrival in College Park in 1993, Sasho Kurovski has transformed the University of Maryland into a national soccer powerhouse. It all started from a small village in North Macedonia near city of Tetovo.
So this is my mother, Lubica, and my father, Trpe, took the picture. My brother, Vanjo, that's myself, and my sister, Diana. And we're all still very close.
He emigrated from Macedonia at the age of 8 and grew up in Ontario, Canada. He accepted a scholarship from the University of Wisconsin to study and play soccer. It changed his life.
When my career as a player ended early because there was no place to play professional soccer when I left college, the North American Soccer League folded. I quickly immersed myself in developing my skill set. So I have a master's degree in business. I took all of the coaching licenses I could, and I became a top young coach.
Money's push up and in!
And at the top is where he has remained.
In 30 years, we've been almost, nine times to the Final Four, which is the semifinal and finals weekend. We've won 3 national championships. That's the most of anybody during the time I've coached in college. So I think we're doing a pretty good job, but the standard is very, very high.
Just kicked it on the bounce. It's a throw-in. There's nothing there.
His life is soccer. On the weekends, Kurovski is watching highlights of major soccer league teams around the world, and he says he has high hopes for the Major League Soccer in the U.S.
the fact that, you know, we've been able to attract players like Beckham and Zlatan and now obviously Wayne Rooney and now Messi coming over here, you know, 6 months after he wins a World Cup, he's playing in the U.S. That's a statement of intent that not only is this a great country to live in, but the quality of soccer or football is improving, and it's very, very high.
In three decades, Kirovsky has built a sterling reputation in soccer, but it's not all work for the coach. At the end of the match, an inevitable part is a delicious ice cream made in his honor. Yana Boyajewski, VOA News, Washington.
And finally today, pandas have become the cutest and cuddliest pawns in Washington's diplomatic tensions with Beijing. In fact, China could be taking its pandas away from the U.S. as a political statement. AP correspondent Tiffany Wong reports.
The three pandas at the National Zoo are set to return to China in early December, and the only pandas left in the U.S. at the Atlanta Zoo will go late next year. China shows no signs of renewing the 50-year-old exchange agreement, and Dennis Wilder for the Initiative for U.S.-China Dialogue on Global Issues at Georgetown University says it can be a punitive measure from Beijing.
Now, the Chinese are angry with us. They're angry over the semiconductor restrictions, the number of sanctions that the Biden administration has placed on Chinese individuals, problems Chinese have now getting visas to the United States. So it could well be possible that they're trying to send a signal.
I'm Tiffany Wong.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is a moment of unprecedented momentum for the relationship between the United States and Mexico, declared Secretary of State Antony Blinken following the recent U.S.-Mexico high-level economic dialogue. Today, Mexico is the United States' largest trading partner.
Our two countries have a shared vision for our economic future, one that's defined by fair competition, openness, transparency. Measuring prosperity not only by how much countries grow, but by how many people share in that growth. By creating the right incentives and business environments and harnessing our two nations' respective strengths, we have a tremendous opportunity to make North America the most competitive, the most productive, the most dynamic region in the world.
The United States and Mexico plan to continue to strengthen, expand, and diversify supply chains in industries like electric vehicles and semiconductors, said Secretary Blinken.
We're launching a joint semiconductor action plan to accelerate our integration, to scale our efforts, to attract new investment. Under President Biden's leadership, we're building regional clean energy technologies and semiconductor supply chains through the Inflation Reduction Act and the Bipartisan Chips and Science Act that will drive our economies through the century.
The U.S. and Mexico are taking steps to improve border coordination, including ways to streamline inspections and reduce wait times, making it easier for people and goods to cross legally while barring fentanyl and other illegal narcotics. We're also addressing the root causes of irregular migration by boosting economic opportunity, said Secretary Blinken.
In southern Mexico, in northern Central America, our development agencies, USAID and AMECID, are supporting 50,000 students, farmers, and others with jobs, with training, with access to markets and capital. When people can make a living, they're less likely to undertake the very dangerous and hazardous journey north.
The U.S. and Mexico are collaborating to ensure that workers on both sides of the border are prepared to succeed in the industries of the future. This includes partnerships like the one between Arizona State University and the National Technological Institute of Mexico, offering Mexican students an 8-week English for the Semiconductor Industry course. By further deepening our economic integration, said Secretary Blinken, I am confident that we'll continue to realize the extraordinary common potential that a vibrant U.S.-Mexico partnership offers.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.